This is part three of the interview with István Deák, recorded on December 5th, 2009. The question he's about to answer is regarding his politics and how they changed over his lifetime. The question was posed by Máté Rigó, who is a graduate student at Cornell University and a PhD candidate there.
This almost belongs to the end of the conversation, because if my political views were extremely limited before the end of the war. But let's say I was under strong influence through the Boy Scouts and the Catholic Gymnasium, and I was quite enthusiastic for any kind of somewhat progressive Catholic movement. So I and some of my classmates who were not indifferent, as most of them were, we were a little bit part of progressive Catholic movements, as for instance Kalot, which was, you know that, very good. This is the young Catholics in the agrarian world, in the rural world, and who dreamed of land reform, strengthening the peasantry, and also a reform, less rigid, less feudal Catholicism. And of course, I'm not a young agricultural youth, so my involvement was somewhat marginal, but nevertheless, I met with several. Then I was also sometimes meeting, or sometimes be invited into our class, into our literary circle. We invited representatives of the Catholic labor movement, which was very small. And there it was very interesting for us to meditate on the question whether it was a good idea or not to weaken the Social Democratic Trade Union movement, which was extremely weak and divided and terribly divided between communists or communist sympathizers and the more moderate ones, and which was barely tolerated by the government. But still, we are 1943 and still there is a Social Democratic Party, then there is a trade union movement, and then there are these young Catholic workers who were very enthusiastic, much more enthusiastic than the old Social Democrats whom I occasionally heard or met, and they very much tried to recruit us from the high school, so that there would be a little bit of an intellectual veneer to what they were doing. And they went on strikes, for instance, so they were not inactive. The strike again was a very difficult problem for them, especially because war is dangerous. They could have been tried and very severely punished, or even advocating strike, but they did nevertheless, and I don't think that any of them got into very big trouble. The bigger trouble was that the main advocates of strikes, especially in 1940, the beginning of the war, when Hungary was still neutral, were the Aero Cross. And they made a big strike, so that should the Catholic workers join the Aero Cross strike or not. The Social Democrats didn't strike because they were supporting the government in order to inform which it hoped that that it would counteract the Nazis. So I was a little bit involved. There were also Jesuits, Pater Bongo, Bela Bongo, Pater Varga, who were actually the main advocates of this socially progressive Catholicism. And some of them were really excellent. And they came to our school, and then there were some associations to which I belonged. And especially Varga, Jesuit Father Varga, saw something in me that he thought that might be of interest to them. And so he invited me several times to their monastery, and we had discussions there, but then I decided that this meeting was not, just as priesthood wasn't for me, that the Catholic movement wasn't for me either, because meanwhile, of course, there is a church that supports the conservative nationalist government, many of whose members, many church leaders were Nazis or practically Nazis. So what good does it do that there are a few halfway decent people? But still, even the Jesuits, who were, these Jesuits, we know, they too were anti-Semitic, but in a very more moderate way. So, overall, my disappointment of the whole Catholic idea was manifold, partly political, partly personal, partly theological. I just began to doubt the Holy Trinity. And since nobody can explain the Holy Trinity to you, because there is no explanation, either you believe or you disbelieve. Once you start disbelieving that, that's the end. then it's almost impossible to stop. So that was some political interest. Towards the very end of the war, after I began sort of disillusioned in my whole Catholic education, I joined a rather ridiculous little group of rich, mostly rich young men who were like me, I think, all of them practically of Jewish origin, who on the other hand were very progressive, and I belonged to their movement, which was called the Jacobins, Hungarian Jacobins. Yes, and we had meetings, and it was a very funny, typical meeting, not unknown in America, that we assembled in the very elegant apartment of one of our friends. The maids came all dressed up and brought us cocoa and cake, and meanwhile we were talking revolution. So it was, that happened here in America also. And then the best part of it was, and that happens, I watched the SDS moving here, the young revolutionary student, and reminded me of that brief period when I was a Jacobin, that one day one of us came and said, I found a worker. I will bring a worker. There will be a worker. And he brought a worker who was actually a street sweeper and who turned out to be very intelligent and a poet. So we listened to his poetry. That I don't remember much more, but I remember that we were all profoundly impressed by the fact that there is a worker among us. I'm sorry? I don't remember, 43, 44, certainly before March 19, 1944. But once the Germans come in, politics play no role because you have to survive. And if any you would join any group, any person who looks like someone who might help you survive and your family to survive, at the same time who might be doing something against the Nazis and their oppressors. And that person was, of course, Béla Stoller. So there was absolutely no problem, because for me, whom to join and whom to follow, whom to regard with admiration, that was Béla, who from the very beginning, after March 19, began was being very active and organized, and organized a group, and had a radio station, set up a radio station, which did not really function, except for a few minutes, I think. It was Szabadság Radio. But he tried to do this, and he collected money and collected materials, or illegally, for this Freedom Radio, which functioned for a while. Then I don't know what happened, because we were called up. All people who are Jews by law had, and they were between the ages, all men, between ages of 18 and 48, had to do labor service. And then I discussed it with Béla, what to do, and he said, the best idea is for you to do labor, join the labor service, because the army, for some reason, is quite protective of the forced laborers, which was absolutely true at that time. And anyway, the war will be over in a few weeks. But that wasn't true, because I joined on June 4, 1944, and the war lasted, at least, this has lasted until February 1945. Meanwhile, my father is in Kisztorcsa at the internment camp. He was arrested 2 days after the German invasion. Some Gestapo men came to our apartment, asked my father whether he was Stefan Deák engineer, and he said yes, and you come with us. I have no explanation beyond that. He was taken to Kisztorcsa, to the internment camp, and there kept with thousands of other people. Now, most of the thousands, they were all Jewish. I mean, again, people who theoretically were Jewish. Most of those were deported by Eichmann, as you perhaps know. After Horthy forbade deportations on July 7, 1944, Eichmann smuggled two trainloads of Jews out of Hungary, literally smuggled behind the back of the Hungarian authorities. All those were people from internment camps, either Kisztarca or Sárkőz, but there were fewer, so mostly Kisztarca. For some reason, my father was not, and several hundred others were not deported, and he has a relatively secure, after this, after July, somewhat more secure and not uncomfortable life, because the Hungarian government put more and more pressure on the Germans to let the Hungarians take over Kisztarca. The Gestapo and Eichmann left Hungary in the summer of 44. Hungary was moving towards surrender, and one of the signs was that in the internment camp, my father was treated quite well. The policemen who were guarding them reported to this they were mostly very influential and wealthy gentlemen who were kept there as hostages. And the commander of the camp, Vasdényei, is one of the righteous, and so wasn't so bad. And he was released, if I'm not mistaken, on October 14, 1944. And he went back to Budapest and, of course, looked up Béla's apartment, and was in Béla's apartment. Now, I go into the labor service to show again how much luck plays important roles. I was supposed to go to Hatvan, change in Hatvan to Jászberény. This is where huge military camp in Jászberény, and that's where we had to report for labor service. Now, Hatvan has had to spend the night because the train all left next day, and there were lot of us, and we were mostly in Boy Scout uniforms and big knapsack. It was more like going to a Boy Scout camp than anything else. What we didn't know that Márton Zöldi, who was one of the Újvidék murderers, he, more or less on his own, he was a gendarmerie captain, he organized the deportation of the people who were going to labor service and descended on Hatvan busy gendarmes and forced them into the trains that were going through Hatvan towards Auschwitz. So most of those who had to go labor service were stopped by the gendarmes in Hatvan and deported to Auschwitz, and of course most of them were killed. I didn't know anything about this. All I know is that I knew that I was in Hatvan. We spent the night near the railroad station, sleeping on cots and on blankets. Then we got to Jászberény, where the treatment was alternately a little bit rude and otherwise almost quite acceptable. There again I know that I had luck. I was lucky because many of us there were put into companies which were then taken to Bor in Serbia. You know about this, the Bor copper camp, copper mines, like Radnoti, and they were either killed in the process or were killed on the way home, mostly by SS and Hungarian Nazis. I escaped all this. Oh yes, I want to mention that I saw a deportation train in Hatvan, but that was not the one on which we were forced. Obviously, there were deportation trains. People were yelling and screaming inside, asking for water. We were not allowed to go near. And there were Hungarian railroad men who were selling water by the bucket. They asked for 50 pengers for a bucket, most of which was spilled by the time it reached this high window. So that was a very terrible thing. I did not realize until that time that there were deportations at all. That was the first sign. But even then, I did not realize that there would be full, that people were deported from the countryside to the last 99-year-old old woman, or the last madman or the last person in prison, or the last of the infants. Everybody was from the countryside. Everybody was deported. And I only realized it a little bit later when I was still in Yazberin camp. For one reason, we were sent in, some of us were sent into camp with a soldier, with a guard, to do something. And there we went through a whole area of Yazberin, which was totally empty, because that's where the Jews had been living in the ghetto, and that the ghetto had been emptied. And then we realized that all the Jews are gone, except us who were in military service. And also realized that all the houses are bare, that people broke into the doors, and emptied them. The moment the Jews left, people took everything. So that's when I became aware of this terror, but I wasn't, even then I wasn't quite conscious of it, because I didn't know, I never heard of Auschwitz. I said, well, they are taken away, but where they would go, I don't think that I gave too much thought of it. Of course, I was very concerned of what happens to us, and what happens to us wasn't so bad. I mean, we were organized, we were taught a little bit how to behave, which we knew very well, because my whole company, more or less the whole company had Boy Scout background, which is a sort of military background, because they were given real military training. So I know I didn't fire many guns, but everything else, what militaries do, besides saluting and marching, we also had military exercises as Boy Scouts all the time, and even they were subjected to gas attacks, and we took them in gas chambers, and they coughed our lungs out. So I knew how to behave in a camp, which also then made it easier for me for the next 6 months where I was in labor service, because I never became conspicuous as too bad, too weak, too untrained. I knew how to behave when I was standing across in front of a soldier. And so then we were taken by train, by the way, open trains. We were sitting like any soldier in the open cattle wagons, but it was quite open, and we looked at the world, and we were fed quite well all through these 6 months, from June 14th to October 15th, when I stepped on oil, Olaira Lepte. Do you know what that is? Olaira Lepte. I fled, yes. But we always talked about Olaira Lepte. We sleep out. We were fed very decently. Now you can. But when I think back of it, what that means, that the army was feeding us decently when other people were starving in Auschwitz, dying of starvation, it's really remarkable how the army, which had the reputation of being so ferociously anti-Semitic, how well it behaves just when you would expect it to behave far worse than ever. Instead, we were saved, we were protected. I mentioned in my other article that a very important step. In June, the Ministry of Defense decided that all labor servicemen were prisoners, should be treated as prisoners of war, which is insane, but when you think, how can you take a Hungarian and treat him as a prisoner of war? But it was a very wise measure, because prisoners of war are protected by the Geneva Convention. And among other things, we were never allowed to leave the camp without a guard, without a soldier. And that time it seemed to us a sort of even unnecessary and humiliating. But in fact it protected us, because he was responsible for us returning to the camp. So then there would have been some Nazis or SS roaming around. At least theoretically, the Hungarian guard would have protected us. It never came to that, so I don't know whether he would have done it genuinely. So then working in the camp, which was in Bethlehem, was arduous. I mean, we had to work, of course, quite hard. We were building a second railroad line from Seredfalva to Deda. You know, there was only one track line leading to Seredfalva. From there you had to take a truck. There were no railroad connecting Székelyföld. But the idea was to build, the Hungarians to the very last minute, they thought that I would lay a new track of train. And this is what we were working on until August 23rd, when the Romanians surrendered. Then everything collapsed, and then suddenly we were ordered to pick up the rail lines, which we laid down, and assembled in Beclean station. Of course, the Romanians and Russians came, and they found it there, and they probably went, took some other prisoners and laid down the line again. And so the insanity of all was is really extraordinary when you think of it. How much energy there is. It's for the very last minute, the Hungarian authorities thought that they would stay forever in Transylvania. Even when the Russians were around the corner already, and the Germans, and the Romanians. But by some miracle, not only this, but you know this, in that after Romania's surrender, the Hungarian army attacked and occupied part of southern Transylvania. We raised the flag and we planted the flag on the southern Carpathians. I mean, they couldn't do that, but they did. They took Torda and they took Arad and many other places and really did perpetrate massacres there. Yeah, very bad. So it wasn't such a bad experience. I might as well cut this short, except to say that when the Romanians surrendered, we were ordered home, back to Hungary, which we did by boarding trains all over the place. I don't even know how we were all kept together because there was no room inside of any car, so we mostly existed on top of the car, of the train, and which was very exciting for an 18-year-old as I was, and I had a wonderful time with my friends, and there were also girls traveling there. So again, this is the time of Auschwitz, and all I can remember how I was sitting next to a girl on the top of a train, and we were sharing some food and having really a very good time. Then we arrived to the Tisza River, Kiskore, which is north of Szolnok, and there we had to rebuild the bridge that had been bombed by the British. We almost finished it when the Russians were approaching, then we had to leave again and went to northern to Felvidék. That's how the train took us. I don't know how it was all arranged, I have no idea. All I know is that we were allowed on our own at that time to go into towns and buy food or ask for food. And at one point we had several pigs and we slaughtered the pigs. It was to me like a big carnival. Until we arrived in October 15 to Újpest, and there we heard Regent. We had heard before that Hungary was about to surrender. Well, why we knew it? Well, I know it, for instance, that one of the bad Karatlagins, one of the bad guards, we had bad ones and good ones, one of the bad guards said, "Don't think that it's over. We will shoot you all before it's over. Even if we lose the war, you won't survive it," he said. But the other guards, for instance, Komjáti was a Hadaprodőrmester, he was a officer candidate, sergeant, he was extremely nice and very friendly. So I would say almost say 50-50. So there were some threats, but nothing materialized. And then October 15, when I heard the speech, I took the streetcar and went, not home, because nobody was home, in our apartment was occupied by someone else, but I went to Béla's place, and I stayed in Béla's apartment, together with many other people for a few days, and then he found me a place to go to, which was the 14/2 Kisegítő Karhatalmi Alakulat, Kiska, which was a semi-legal, semi-military organization that had been set up by Horthy in order to counteract the Nazis if necessary, and became a refuge for military deserters, political deserters, and political refugees, and others. But it was legal. I mean, we had but sort a semi-uniform, and as I mentioned in which you heard, I had a pistol, and went around, and I even had cocktail, so I looked like a gendarme. we looked like gendarmes, and people, it's really terrible when I think of it, how terrified people were when they saw me, how Jews were when they saw me. And I went into the ghetto, and every place I went to looking for my grandmother, people were terrified when they saw me. But who knows what I was up to. And then they found out that I was very polite, and they said, here's a polite murderer. But it was very difficult, because I couldn't say, look, don't worry about me. I had to be maintain a certain stance. Otherwise, the others, there were a lot of gendarmes and policemen around, and even Aerocross, they would have taken me. But nobody asked me any questions. So that, I went in and out of the ghetto several times looking for my grandmother, whom we first tried to pull out of the masses of people who had been deported and were marching on the highway toward Vienna, but we could never find her again. We took another old lady out of the line and expedited her to a relative that she could name and address. She could give us, although she was really more or less out of her mind. But the grandmother, she's gone. And it was a terrible thing because that's really the worst part of my life. We were all safe in a house, in an apartment which Bela helped us find. No, actually we find that the renter or the owner of the house, of the apartment was near Lake Balaton, and he was happy that somebody was taking care of the apartment, so we lived in that apartment. Everybody was there, except grandmother, Jozsef Körút 68. Except grandmother, who was in a Csillagos house, with her friends, old ladies' friends. And she didn't want to come out because she, unlike us, was not baptized, didn't know anything about Catholic religion, and she felt that she was safe in that house and she would be very unsafe outside because she wouldn't have been able to answer a single question. And Béla and all of us, except my mother, agreed. My mother said we should bring her out against her will. And we didn't do it because we found it easier to leave her where she was because there was a possibility that she would endanger everybody by not knowing the right answer because you were asked to say the Paternoster or something, which she didn't know. And because we sort of persuaded ourselves that she was very safe where she was. She wasn't. She was taken out in November, one day, all of them in the house and marched off in this horrible rain to the Téglagyár in Óbuda and from there on the road to Vienna. And Béla also went after her and tried to bring her home, but he couldn't find her. And we don't know how that happened. And I don't think that was a crime because it was a question of what is better. But I always have this in my conscience. I had a voice less than Béla or my sister, but my father was still had a voice. And I don't know whether it was, the choice was because it was genuinely felt that it was better for her, or it was because we felt or I felt it was better for us. And had she come out, I don't think that anything would have happened to her. We were never subjected to a kind of questioning in which people would be unmasked. There were a lot of people hiding. Budapest was full of deserters, military deserters, and other deserters. So that there was at that time, this is December 1944 already, a time when there was a sort of a solidarity among some kind of solidarity among people. And we were never betrayed by anyone, we were never denounced by anyone, nobody ever threatened us, and we lived, that is, my parents and my sister lived sort of relative security, whereas I was in that semi-military unit, which was again quite pleasant. Until the Nazis arrested us, the SS arrested us on January 4, 1945. Obviously, then there was a denunciation. But one morning, the SS came and arrested the whole group. We were about 50, I would say, in this so-called company. But, and they arrested us, two of them, two SS arrested all 50 of us. Because we were asleep and because we were not soldiers. And SS know how to behave when it comes to such things. And they said that they would shoot us, but then they didn't shoot really anybody at the end. This was enough. Anyway, I escaped. We found that one of the SS who guarded us was a German, was a Hungarian German, and he let us go. I told you about that in the other interview. Didn't tell that person, one of the persons with whom I escaped, had a big black mustache and very thick black hair, and I have no idea who was his name. He called himself Gabor. And then he took us to the next street where he had a friend who was a composer, Yardani, and you know the name? I'm sorry? Yes, Yardani Poli. Yardani Poli, that's right. And then the man with the big mustache and big black hair introduced himself and he said, I'm Major Ákos. No, not Major Ákos. No. Major Ákos was the brother, the judge, and this Major Tomás, the actor and later director of the National Theater, who was totally bald. So he was an actor. He knew how to wear a wig. And so it was very interesting. And then I just had maybe 10 more days until the Russians came. And then the Russians came and then all hell broke loose, but that's really not story. So that's how I survived. My father was all the time there. Oh, before, while my father is in internment camp and I'm in labor service, my sister and mother are at different places. They are at different places. My mother is in a summer resort and my sister works as a governess for an aristocrat. They had the papers. You saw my mother's ID card, and so they never had any trouble either. I mean, this is simplifying. There were little adventures here and there, but overall they had no trouble. So that's what I mean. To be a privileged was a totally different situation from those who had, for one reason or another, could not use their good connections, didn't happen to have a friend like Béla Stola. We probably would have survived even Béla Stola without him, but it would have been more difficult. Okay.
Maybe you could tell us about your first contact with communism.
Well, the first contact with communism was a Russian soldier who came into the cellar. Oh, before that, with communism, except for such ridiculous incident as when I was 12 or 13, I found a hammer and sickle emblem. And I took it home and my father made me throw it. He said, it's very dangerous, throw it out. After that, there is big silence. Communism is for me the enemy. I mean, I didn't like communism. Although I began to sympathize with liberty in 44, I said, certainly the Russians are going to liberate us and they cannot be so bad. And Béla, who was a resistor and died for it, was also a very strong anti-communist. And he said, Csajka bol fogunk sorba állni. Ne hitt, hogy ennyi jobb lesz a kommunistákkal. So he was very decidedly non-communist, maybe not anti-communist, but just decided non-communist. Oh, well, that was such a short thing, and we were talking about the French Revolution, obviously, you know, this one. We were lecturing each other. I don't remember. Again, I don't remember whether we talked about communism. I certainly did not end the war with any kind of special sympathy for communism. Yes, for the Soviet soldiers who liberated us. I mean, I was grateful. It was a great event when the Soviet soldiers came, even though they were disappointing in many ways, but one tended to forgive that. If you were in a situation like myself, one tended to forgive it. Whereas for the others, it was an occupation, it was not liberation, and for the others, for the non-Jewish, non-persecuted people, it was a terrible event, which in their memories becomes worse and worse, and aggrandized, nothing but rape and robbery, and which wasn't true. I mean, there was a lot of bad things, but not every soldier was a murderer, not every was a bandit, and not every soldier was drunk. And they had to have a very difficult war to fight, which they fought. And I mean, it was again a question of luck. I mean, if you were captured, as I was several times by the Russians, in order to do labor for them or to go to POW camp, and you didn't manage to escape as I did, then you ended up in Siberia and your chances of survival were very poor. How many? Not even half of those civilians who were taken from Budapest and other places survived. According to Tamás, the civilians had a very high death rate because they were not at all used to it. Plus they had nothing. I mean, I was taken by the Russians with my little jacket. And then the idea that you go to Siberia wearing a jacket is not very tempting. So I managed to escape. And well, twice it happened to me. But the trouble was you didn't know what they wanted from you. So sometimes when they said Malinky Robot, it could be little robot or it could be a big robot in Siberia. No, nobody, they didn't know either. They had no idea what the outcome will be. This was ordered to take 100 men, so they took 100 men. And for them, all these things were no problem. One of the Russian soldiers said to me, "Why are you complaining? We were talking some broken German. Why are you complaining?" Few years ago I was in Moscow and then they ordered me to Siberia and to work and they went to Siberia. What's that? Why not? So, we understood that it was a different mentality. But there's no communism yet on the horizon. However, that's true, that after a while when things were a little bit less hectic, I began to look around of what I should do, how I should work, and how I should find some home, political home. And I went to see the young communists and the young social democrats and some others, the smallholders. And the ones who made the best impression on me were the communists. Very open, very friendly, very highly intellectualized, at least at that group of young girls and young men who said te to me immediately and were very, very immediate and direct, and who reminded me of my Jacobin club. I guess most of them were also Jewish, although that I can't guarantee, but sort of thinking back to some of the characters I saw there. But I did not want to join them. I did not want to be a communist. So at the end, since everybody had to join, I joined the social. I became a social democrat. Member of Social Democratic Party and then Social Democratic Rendezvegardo, Social Democratic, not police, but sort of could be Rendezvegardo in English. What? Order police, maybe. At party meetings, they keep order. Yeah, sort of. I mean, it consisted of absolutely nothing. Except I had which I have somewhere, my ID card that the Social Democratic Party gave me, and which was totally worthless. The Russians didn't even read it. But that was also very short, and then I decided that I wasn't interested in any political activity. I had to work, did a lot of physical labor for us to live, and then I finally went to a bookstore and found a job there, Lontos Antiquariat. And I really had no time for politics and no great inclination. I was very interested, of course. I read about it and, well, no, that's wrong. I went to several meetings. I was very, very, very enthusiastic about a new party which was being set up by Imre Kovács, Zsolt Béla, Béla Zsolt, and Károly Pálya. These were dissidents from their own parties, the peasant party, Kovács Imre, Pálya, social democrat, and Zsolt from the citizens party, Polgári party. And they got together and they had a big meeting and in Zen Academia, and there I was very, very there, very much there and very enthusiastic, and this is what I should join. These are progressive, democratic, but not at all communist. In fact, they are dissident from parties that were about to go communist. And there I had the only conflict in my political life, that while the speeches were made, a bunch of young workers came in, or people who claimed to be workers, they had blue shirts, and they started making a huge racket, and so you couldn't hear a word. And I said to one of them, shut up, we can't hear the speakers. And then they said, you are a fascist, and they started attacking me and beat me up. And there was a policeman, and they sort of called on the policeman to help me, and he turned his back. And that's why, actually, main reason why I left Hungary, because I saw that the police will not defend me. Many people in Hungary have the feeling today that police is not going to be able to, not willing to defend. No, I'm sure that the policeman wasn't, he wasn't an evil person. He just did not want to risk his position. When it's clear that disruption of the political meeting was organized by the communists, who are now more and more in power, this is 1947. Then came the elections of 1947. So my encounter with communists, except for the first meeting with some young enthusiast, was very negative, because 1947 election, my father was disqualified. We looked up the law under which he was disqualified as prostitution. And so he went to complain, but of course nobody paid any attention to it. But my sister and I, my mother, we voted, and we didn't vote. And then, but I was election observer for the smallholder party. Nothing, I wasn't a member of the party, but somebody had to volunteer to be an observer. And there I saw the Kék-Cédulás választás. You know what I'm talking about? Rajk, who was Minister of Interior, handed out tourist IDs to thousands of communists. The law, which was, I think, a crazy law, unless the communists deliberately had introduced it, said that if somebody is not at home, he can vote in any district once he applies for a special card. So they were driven around in trucks, and they came to our place, they invaded the place, and they voted, and we all knew what was happening, and we all grumbled. We counted the number, it was already four, so we didn't know what the true number was. But anyway, it made no difference, because the statistics as published in the newspaper were also forged, deliberately forged. So we were quite, definitely forged. So we were quite sure that this is it. I mean, these two things, that I was not that I was beaten, I wasn't so terribly beaten, but sort of pushed around and a little bit hit on the head, not seriously. But that this could happen without the police interfering, and at the election, which was so clearly falsified, rigged, persuaded me that I had to leave. That's very pedestrian. I'm sorry that I can't provide you with more amusing and more dramatic stories. I was looking for a way to leave, and then my father told me that a friend of his, whom I knew quite well, and who had this background of applied arts, he was buying and selling applied art during the war or before the war, and even after the war, that he was about to exhibit Hungarian blouses, folk art, in the Marseille trade fair. Now, his name was Unterreiner, and he, Baron Unterreiner, and he had only one leg because he lost a leg in World War I. And so in his application he wrote that he needed a crutch, a help, because he cannot carry anything being one-legged, and he needs, and he would like me to go with him. And so I applied for a passport and I got a passport, and he didn't. So I left. I got the crutch, I bought the crutch, but he couldn't. He walked out at the end on his one leg, walked out across the frontier, and ended up in West also. Good fortune was that I was working in the Lantos bookstore, antiquariat, and one of perhaps the first consul of the French legation came very often to our place to buy prints and old books. He invested it very well. He bought extremely beautiful books for almost nothing. The inflation and everything made it possible to buy wonderful things in Hungary. And so he was very friendly to me, and I went to him and said, I now have a Hungarian passport, but I know that it's very tenuous, because sooner or later they will find out that I got a passport, that person whom I'm supporting didn't get the passport, so it must have been a mistake. And could he help me to get a French visa? And they called and arranged it, and within 24 hours I got the visa, and within another 24 hours I left Hungary, legally by train. I went to Paris. So I mean, that's, my name is rather pedestrian. I can't say that I walked across and the dogs were after me or something.
I'm sorry?
It
must have been hard. I mean, you arrived at Paris, you were on your own.
Yeah, I was very much on my own. I was only allowed to take $5. $5, but it was a lot of money at that time, but still. And also, I had save some money, and so I put $100 bill in the tube of toothpaste. And then I arrived there, and I had, well, this is such a long story, and you really want to hear all this? So I was in the train, and it was endless. It took so long from Budapest to Paris. I thought, you have to cross first the Hungarian border. I wasn't worried there. I was more worried when crossing the Austrian zone from the Russian to the American zone, because the Russians were known for stopping people, not letting them go, and in which case you would have been forced to go back to Hungary. But they let me go, and then we crossed the Enns. This is from Unterösterreich to Oberösterreich. And then I saw what the Western world, or what the America is, and that is going to be my home one day. That, because whereas the Russians were very serious and very proper, but serious, suddenly we saw some white helmeted soldiers who were shouting to each other and joking and laughing, and then they jumped on the moving train. They didn't even stop the train, just went through the train and asked for the passports of the immigrants. Looked at them left and right, very, very casually, and joked around with each other, and gave somebody a cigarette. It was a different world, I knew that. And also to see in the compartment, everybody was suddenly changed. Everybody was stiff with fright before, and once we were in the American zone, people relaxed and began to tell stories of how they were in the train, and what they were smuggling, and what they wanted to do and in the future. And then through Switzerland, and Switzerland was an incredible experience. Already Western Austria was an incredible experience, unlike Eastern Austria, which was just as poor as Hungary, not poorer actually. But Western Austria was already like Switzerland, clean and proper and chocolate and everything else. And then of course to go to Zurich, and it was a different world, totally different world. I knew that such thing must have existed, but to see it with your own eyes coming from Hungary, and how nicely people can live, was a great experience. And then finally I go to Paris, and there I had a suitcase, and I went to the Place de l'Opéra by metro to see it, and carrying my suitcase, and I went back to Gare Saint-Lazare, because I knew that there would be a place with cheap hotels. And then I went to a street which was called Rue Budapest. And now which shows that you don't laugh even more, is that everybody, at least at that time, I don't know what the situation is now, everybody knew, as I was told later, that Rue Budapest is nothing but, is a total red light district. Did you know that?
It's near
Pigalle. Well, it's Saint-Lazare. No, it's not, it's not that far from the Pigalle. And so I went to walk past these hotels, and there were girls in front of every hotel, and Viens mon prince, and mon petit prince, and things like this. And then I said, I'm certainly not available, I have no money, and anyway, I'm looking for hotel. I just arrived in Paris. And then two girls very nicely walked with me, said, not here, this is expensive. C'est à l'heure. I mean, that's only for the hour, and that's expensive. But we know another place, and they walked with me to Rue de Liège, and there was a hotel called Hotel de Liège. And they took me in, and the patron, when he saw us, me with two girls, immediately ran away and came with three towels. But I said, no, I want to sleep. I haven't slept in 3 days. And they said, no, monsieur est là pour dormir. And so I got a room. And that was my first domicile. Was very inexpensive even for those times. Was 2,000 francs a month. 2,000 vieux francs, that is really 20 nouveau francs. And that means 2,000 was $5 a month, which I couldn't have paid. I could have paid had I kept the $100. But my neighbor was a Hungarian, of course, everybody was Hungarian. And he came and befriended me, and he said, how much money do you have? And I said, $5 and $100 bill. And he said, that's a joke in France, that was too little, it's, things are very expensive. We have to do something about for you to get more money, and give me the $100, I have a roulette method. And then he lost it, of course. So I was left with $5. But then I found work, quite soon. So that's it, now I'm in Paris. Should we continue? I'm so bored with my own stories. Are you not? No. Okay, so then I'm in Paris and I look around for some people whom I might meet, and I was told to go to the I had some addresses, and one of them was for a young Hungarian who had a fellowship. There were quite a few Hungarians on a fellowship there, maybe 20. Who had the fellowship from Budapest, from Hungary, and I should go to see him and maybe has an idea of how I can live, survive. I went there and found almost all of them together in a hotel room, and they told me that just then they were told to sign a manifesto asking for the execution of Mindszenty, which they refused to do with one or two exceptions. Whereupon they were told by the Hungarian legation that if they don't sign, they will lose their fellowship and have to go back to Hungary. And so that's what they were discussing, and I sat down with them, and then suddenly I was part of this complex, even though personally I was not involved in this terrible dilemma, and they, most of them, refused to sign, and then therefore they became refugees. And so I became a refugee with them, not immediately, because my visa was good for 3 months, and during the 3 months I was treated as a tourist. For instance, I got gasoline tickets. There were still ration cards. Gasoline was rationed, unlike in Hungary. Bread was rationed, milk. And so I could sell the gasoline ration card with some profit. But after 3 months, you suddenly end, your existence ends. The French said, you have a visa for 3 months, you promised not to ask for a renewal, you understood that there could be no renewal, you have to leave. But I didn't leave, and I told this police agent, whom I had to see, that I will not go back to Hungary, because it's a country that I don't want to go back, it's political. Impossible, I would like to be a political refugee. So they sent me to IRO, International Refugee Organization, which gave me a paper that I want to be a refugee, which I took back to the police, and the police then gave me a paper which said that I was applying for a permit to stay in France. Récépissé d'une demande de titre d'identité, d'identité, récépissé, so an acknowledgement that they asked for it, was valid for 3 days. So every 3 days I had to go back to the prefect, to the police, and stand in line and say, here I am, I'm not leaving France, I would like to stay. Then they asked me, where is my work permit? I said, I have no work permit, because without a card d'identité I cannot ask for a work permit. So go back to the Ministry of Labor, and went to the Ministry of Labor, where is your card d'identité? I don't have a card d'identité. So nothing could be done. I went back and forth like all of us did. But we understood that this is a game that we were told by old hands, that this was a game that the French bureaucracy was playing, but at the end they will never expel us. And that was the only country, I think, really, in which that was possible. For instance, there was no way of going to England or to America. It's out of question that I would have received a visa under such conditions to America, to the United States. The quota was 750 a year, was totally filled many years in advance. And so France was actually the main hope. They tried to persuade you, the French tried to persuade you to go to the mines in the north or work in agriculture, because that's what they needed. And we wanted to pray in Paris and not do anything. So, so there's a sort of difference in opinion of what we should do. But at the end, yes, and then I had a friend with whom I was sharing a room, and he got some money from America from his uncle, money meaning $10, $20, that was a lot of money at that time. And so we managed. And then I found work, first in Les Halles, in the marketplace, then in a bookstore, but they didn't pay me. So I had to work at night. Then I worked as a night guard, which was of course a joke, because I was a substitute for a substitute of a genuine night guard. And the genuine night guard did not have to do this, because he was a Hungarian Nazi who had came to France much earlier, and therefore was a happy owner of a carte d'identité de résident privilégié. Privilege, 10 years the permit. Once you had this, you could work. And since he had the right to work, he wouldn't be crazy to work. He sublet it to people who had no right to work. And it was actually, I was the substitute of a substitute. And therefore, I earned unbelievably little money. But still, I earned a little money. But it was difficult. I mean, I moved from that hotel to an even worse hotel. And Ile Saint-Louis, which is now a very fancy area, but at that time it was the bottom, I must say. And I was starving, and I got scurvy. I told you this. Didn't I tell anything? What did we talk about the last time? I got scurvy. I went to the American hospital saying that I have bleeding gums and everything else, and they looked at it and said, you have scurvy, which is really quite an achievement, no? To get scurvy in France, in Paris. But I had no money, so I was eating rotten dates and things like this, and that didn't help me. I guess I had no C vitamin. That's what I should have had. And they put me then, they gave me a sort of a certificate which allowed me to eat in certain places in Paris. I went regularly to the Maronites, to the Lebanese Maronites monastery, where I was given very good food, lunch, and that helped me. But I lost a few teeth as a result. But then I found some other part-time work, and I had this worked in a workshop, in an atelier, where they were making toy animals, and there was one of the workers there who helped to make toy animals, and elephants, stuffing elephants, cork. And then I finally was helped by IRO, also by IRC, International Refugee International, IRC is a very big organization. Rescue, International Rescue Committee. It's not, the UN is IRO, but IRC is an American private organization, non-denominational. And they helped me by giving me clothing and also by sending me to a school to learn library science, of which I have a document, I have a diploma. They also sent me to school in Alliance Française, and there I got a diploma as a teacher of French. So I'm very proud of that. I never taught, but I had the diploma. And then there was an American who looked for a Hungarian, for a French translator, and they acted as his translator for about a year. But all this was, again, without any hope, because I still didn't have a decent card identity. I still had to live for months to months, and traveling was extremely difficult, although I managed to get to Holland, and I managed to get to England, and I was harvesting for a month with fellow French students, because I was already also inscribed at the Sorbonne, and we went to harvest, and for the money that I saved in England, this is 1950, the money I saved in England, I had another month to live in London. So I earned £1 a day and had almost no expenses because we lived in army barracks and we were fed. So I saved enough money for a month's stay in England, which was wonderful, although England was so poor and the rationing was so extensive that it was not easy. But I had a wonderful time. I told you about, didn't I tell you about Downing Street? I never told any stories. What did I tell in class? So that, this should be the other thing. Wait a minute, what time is it? 6:30? 6. Well, oh, very quickly then, this is the done. I was living in a Salvation Army hostel, which was very nice, by the way. But I had some addresses for this. I went to London, stayed in the Salvation Army hostel, and in Paris I got a few telephone numbers from friends and said, these are young people whom you should call, and they're very nice. One of them was for a girl called, Peggy. That they should call Peggy, and they called her. He didn't, I forgot the last name, I didn't write the last name. Just I said, call Peggy, she's a very nice girl. I called Peggy, and yes, she said, yes, Cyril Makrov recommended you. Then, of course, he's a friend of Cyril, he's my friend. We should meet. We met at the National Gallery, and she wasn't very pretty, I must say, but she was hefty, but very, very pleasant. And so I met her a few times, and then a second or third time she said, rather than walking around in the streets all the time, why don't you come and visit my home? And so we took the bus. We got to a very nice, quiet street. And she took me to one of the buildings, and there was a policeman in front of the building, but I didn't pay him. Well, a policeman can be standing in the street. There out came a man, a white-haired gentleman, and Peggy said, this is Mr. Morrison, and this is Mr. Deak. And they still didn't, the light didn't go up. You know who Mr. Morrison was? No. Well, and then I said, but where are we? And she said, we are at 10 Downing Street. She was the daughter of Sir Stafford Cripps, the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain. And she introduced me. And who, the Foreign Secretary, lives at 11 Downing Street. But we were in front of 10 Downing Street. And she took me in, and she took me around. I was in the council room, where Churchill used to be sitting. And I went there regularly from the Salvation Army to 11 Downing Street, and met the parents, Sir Stafford Cripps, and the ladies. There were, this is the, Cripps was the maniac of austerity. And it was a left labor, very pro-Soviet left labor politician who is judged rather negatively today because his austerity policy was actually not a good thing because it didn't get the economy moving. But he was an egalitarianist, and so everybody had to take the same blow, which included his own family. They only had one egg a week or something like this, and lived like dogs. But still, it was a great invention. I sat down at a desk and she gave me letterheads. So, foreign secretary, Sir Stafford, I wrote to my parents.